The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
Everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for tuning in this week. And thank you to our listener, Andy, for suggesting the case we'll be covering today. There are more potential suspects in this case than probably any other case we've covered. So since there's definitely a lot to discuss, let's get into it. Amy Gellert was 21 years old at the time of her murder in 1994. Amy grew up with two brothers in Cocoa Beach, Florida, often considered the surfing capital of the East Coast. When Amy was just 3 years old, her parents divorced. So Amy and her two brothers primarily lived with their mom, Charlotte, who went by Bunny, in Cocoa Beach. The siblings were incredibly close, sharing everything with each other. In an interview with 48 Hours, Amy's brother Ryan said she was feisty, gutsy, and just had a lot of life in her. At age 5, a couple of years after her parents divorced, Amy's mom, Bunny, had moved on to a new relationship with a psychologist named Bob Layton, and the pair married shortly thereafter. Now, Bunny was a psychologist too, so they had that in common. Bunny was described as more bubbly, while Bob was laid back, but they were also both devout Christians. Bunny and Bob routinely hosted Bible studies in their home, taught Sunday school, and often flew Bob's small plane to attend church gatherings in other states. Bob had, and I believe still has, a private practice in Cocoa Beach where Bunny worked as well that he opened in the 1980s. Not long after Bunny and Bob married, according to 48 Hours, Amy's life took a drastic turn when she became seriously ill with encephalitis and inflammation of the brain that left her with learning disabilities. Bunny explained that Amy was then held back a year in school, and this illness greatly affected her. Despite this, Amy persevered and carried on until high school when she hit a rough patch. One of Amy's close friends from high school described her as someone truly unique with a distinct presence. She recalled that from her perspective, meaning from the friend's perspective, while Amy's mom, Bunny, had hoped for a daughter who was a girly girl, so to speak, Amy was anything but. Amy seemed to take pride in her rebellious nature, often pushing boundaries and challenging her mom's expectations.
Do you have any examples of how she defied her mom's expectations?
Yes, it all kind of started when Amy began seeing some of her classmates experiment with drugs. When Amy saw this, she decided to experiment herself. She began smoking marijuana, but it turned into a habit, something she was doing with greater frequency than most of her peers. Bunny told 48 Hours that Amy was not a weekend warrior, someone who just smoked marijuana on the weekends or socially. It was beyond that. So it began to cause problems academically and at home. We have to remember she was just a teenager at this point. This drove Bunny to send 15-year-old Amy, despite her pushback, to a rehab program an hour away in Orlando, Florida, a highly controversial program called Straight. We could do an entire episode on Straight, but that's not what we're here for. So at a high level, they had numerous locations across the country and faced allegations of abuse and psychological mistreatment, leading to various lawsuits.
Was Bunny aware of the reputation at the time when she sent Amy to this place?
She knew it was considered a tough rehab, but it didn't necessarily have this reputation yet. It's widely condemned for its practices now, but back then when Amy went to the rehab, it's not as though this was all known and Bunny thought she was sending her daughter somewhere she'd be abused. When she returned, this was 2 years before her murder in 1992, she seemed to be doing well. Once she returned home, she grew more involved in the church her parents attended and made a new group of friends there. But as we'll discuss later, turned out that Amy did start using drugs again before her murder, but that was not known to everyone in her life. She also enrolled at a local community college and began working as an assistant sound engineer, some sources say recording technician, at her church. Amy had a passion for music, so this was a natural fit for her. So Amy seemed to be doing well in the week leading up to her murder in March 1994. There were no incidents that could have foreshadowed what was to come. Several hours before Amy's murder, on Sunday, March 20th, 1994, she went out to eat with her dad. We haven't talked about her dad, Dan, much at all, but Amy and her dad remained close after he and her mom divorced. Dan said they could talk about everything with each other and they enjoyed going on vacations. And that's something he really cherished. As she got older, they started to take vacations together. They hadn't as much when she was younger, I believe. So that's something he really cherished and was glad they got to do before her murder. During that lunch, Amy was excited because Bunny and Bob had just purchased a new vehicle and passed down Bunny's Volkswagen to Amy. That evening was described as a beautiful spring night. March 20th was the first day of spring that year, and it didn't disappoint. It was about 70 degrees with clear skies when Amy headed to an evening church service with her mom and stepdad around 7:30. And I say with them, but Amy drove separately in her new car because she'd be working the soundboard during the service, so she'd have to stay a little bit later than Bunny and Bob. Bunny and Bob arrived home early, around 8:30 p.m. after the Sunday service. I'm not clear on why they were considered early, but reports state that they were home earlier than was typical after church. They walked inside and encountered a man in a black ski mask. They were shocked. There had been no car outside to indicate they had a guest. The intruder was fully covered and they had no idea who this person was. He ordered them to get on their hands and knees and crawl from the kitchen to the living room. They had reason to comply, considering he brandished a handgun and knife. They were ordered to lie on the floor. Bob went down first on his stomach, then Bunny was instructed to lie on Bob's back on her stomach. Their bodies were perpendicular, kind of like a plus sign if you're trying to visualize this. And if you think this positioning is strange, you're not the only one, but we will come back to it later on in this episode.
Yeah, I suppose the reason that I'm thinking of that this burglar would tell them to get in that position would be to prevent Bob from getting up quicker in an effort to stop this person?
Yeah, I would think they would want the person they think is more likely to try to fight back on the bottom and the person who's more willing to comply on top. I don't know if that's how they assess the situation with Bunny and Bob. It could be, or it could be that there was some other reason that they use this tactic. But like I said, we'll talk about it a little bit later. But that makes sense to me that you would want to make it more difficult for them to stand up quickly. While they were on the floor, at one point, the intruder sat on Bunny, shoving his knee into her back and tapping the blunt end of his knife on her head. He was also very careful about them seeing his face. He made sure they didn't look at him for too long, even though he had a mask on.
I'm assuming that's because they may be able to recognize his eyes or his mouth. Did they recognize his voice?
They did not recognize his voice, and they did not recognize the eyes of this person. As far as they knew, this was a stranger in their home. They were with this man for about 30 minutes, and Bunny and Bob described him as nice and friendly.
Do we know how this man got into the house?
Yes, he told them he got in through an unlocked door, and he even kind of scolded them about leaving the door unlocked, telling them, you should have left your door locked. I wouldn't have been able to get in. So yeah, that was interesting to me that he was telling them exactly how he got in and how they should keep their doors locked. The intruder said he did not want to hurt them, which makes sense considering he was so adamant that they not see his face, but he asked for money. They only had a little bit of cash on hand, so Bob gave him $50 he had in his pocket. And at some point, the offender obtained a few credit cards from them as well. Bunny had expensive jewelry that she offered him, along with other valuables, but he turned down the offers. Now, there's a strong theory that Amy was the intended target. She was not home yet as this was going on, but the intruder asked who lived at the house besides them. And Bunny told 48 Hours that she said, our daughter lives here too. And from that point, he repeatedly asked when their daughter was going to be home. So he said, your daughter. He did not say Amy, and they did not tell him her name. And we don't need to get into this in depth now, but it is interesting that if he were waiting for Amy, he did not slip up and refer to her as Amy.
Yeah, I guess on the flip side, he could have recognized that more than just Bunny and Bob lived there and wanted to know if the other person that lived there was going to come home at some point and catch him.
Yes, that's possible too. It could be that he truly had no idea who Amy was and was fearful that someone was going to walk in and be another issue, another person for him to have to deal with. And that's a good point, because why would he ask who lives at the home unless he truly didn't know? Unless he could have been smart enough to do that, to throw investigators off later, but we don't know if he was worried about when Amy would arrive home because she was the target, or because, like you said, he didn't want to deal with another person in this situation. The man paced back and forth and looked at his watch numerous times while they were on the floor. He indicated that he was waiting for a ride. As he paced, he released the magazine from his gun multiple times and popped it back in. One time, the magazine fell on the floor and Bob noted that it sounded lightweight or hollow. It did not sound solid, which he thought was surprising. Although the intruder fiddled with the gun, they said he seemed sort of unfamiliar with it, whereas he appeared to be very familiar and comfortable with the knife. According to 48 Hours, Bunny and Bob offered that he take one of their cars parked in the garage. They would give him the keys. You know, the ride's not showing up. It seems like this person's taking a long time to show up. So they said, you know what? Just take one of our cars. We don't care. Basically, they just wanted him out of there. But he asked if the cars had manual transmissions, and they told him yes, at which point he seemed uninterested in their cars. It wouldn't have been wise for him to take one of their cars anyway, but it seemed like a non-starter because he probably didn't know how to drive a car with a stick shift. After about 30 minutes, the intruder went from kind to enraged right after Amy's car pulled into the driveway. Her headlights illuminated the inside of their dark home. And Bunny knew it was Amy and not someone the offender was waiting for because she was blasting her music. The intruder lost it and began stabbing and slashing at Bunny and Bob. Bunny told 48 Hours that the stabs were going so deep that she could feel and hear bones crunching within her, a sound that she was unable to forget all these years later. It was a fairly short attack because Bob managed to escape and run outside, followed by the intruder. The intruder then attacked Amy as she got out of her car. He stabbed Amy in the head and neck several times, and she attempted to protect herself with a bag she had in her arms as the attack began, but he managed to get to her anyway. The offender fled the scene in the direction of the Atlantic Ocean. Their house was not on the beach. He'd have to cross two streets to get to it, but it would only take a minute or so to get there. After the stabbing, Amy ran across the street to an apartment complex parking lot, leaving a trail of blood, where she came across a neighbor who had just arrived home. She told this neighbor that she had been stabbed before she collapsed. Moments later, the first call to 911 was placed at 9:07 p.m. Bonnie and Bob lived in a small, unincorporated pocket of Brevard County, four blocks south of the Cocoa Beach city line. So because of the way the response system worked, the agency sent to help was not the physically closest agency. County paramedics were sent rather than city paramedics, and they arrived 10 minutes after the initial 911 call from 6 miles away. So it took them 8 minutes to drive there based on when they received notification of the incident. 2 minutes later, sheriff's deputies arrived and secured the scene for them to render aid and transport her to a hospital. They could not assist her until they received approval from law enforcement. So Amy was lying on the ground for about 12 minutes, and Bunny and Bob also needed medical attention. Amy, who was not breathing, was rushed to a local hospital along with Bunny and Bob. They had all lost a significant amount of blood, but Amy's attack proved to be fatal. There was nothing the medical professionals could do to save her life. Bunny and Bob, on the other hand, pulled through. After surgery and 4 days after the attack, Bunny was released a little bit sooner than Bob, who was discharged not long after. If not for Bunny and Bob's survival, much of what I've shared thus far would be unknown. They are obviously witnesses and victims too, but they spent about 30 minutes with the man who killed Amy. You'd think that would make this case much easier to solve. And they provided valuable information, some of which we've already discussed, although they didn't speak publicly until 5 years after Amy's murder. Bunny said it was very difficult to talk about what they went through, and she said she's a private person by nature, so it was hard to open up about the incident. The Brevard County Sheriff's Office led the investigation and interviewed more than 100 people within the first few days. According to contemporaneous newspaper articles, they received their first lead when a transient man was in possession of some of Bunny and Bob's credit cards. As you might recall, the intruder left with credit cards belonging to them. The man turned the credit cards into a bank, and law enforcement tracked him down. He told the investigators that he found the credit cards on the ground near a hospital several miles from Bunny and Bob's home. By the time the sheriff's office got a hold of the credit cards, they'd lost all potential forensic value because they'd exchanged hands so many times.
Were they able to figure out if the credit cards were used?
They were not used. Yeah, so it kind of seems like the intruder just discarded them probably right after the murder or realized it was a bad idea that he took them.
Yeah, why even take them at all if this man's purpose for the visit was to kill Amy?
Right. And we don't know 100% why he was there. But I will say Bunny and Bob said the theft component of this seemed like an afterthought to him. Kind of like he thought, well, I might as well. I'm already here. I might as well take whatever cash you have and take your credit cards.
Yeah. And it could have been to throw them off. Mixing in the theft aspect of this may have thrown them off the scent of this guy just directly targeting Amy. It could make it seem like a stranger did this rather than someone that Amy directly knew.
Right. That could have been their intention of taking anything from them to throw investigators off. And it has proven to throw them off because to date, they don't 100% know the motive in this case. Ultimately, the investigators found no link between this transient man and Amy's murder. So it appeared that the true offender or someone involved with them discarded these credit cards, likely while inside a vehicle. The investigators turned their attention to the intruder's weapons, both of which turned out to be unusual. They learned more about the knife, typically described as a dagger, from Bunny and Bob. The offender took the knife with him when he fled the scene, and it has not been recovered. But Bunny and Bob explained it had an ornate hilt that sort of looked like a gold chain. Law enforcement developed a sketch of the knife based on Bunny and Bob's description. So we will share that on our Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast. They've said, of course, it may not have looked exactly like that, but the sketch should be pretty close. And when I saw the sketch, I thought it definitely had a unique appearance. The assailant also fled with his gun. However, the magazine came out of the gun somehow during the attack, and the sheriff's office recovered it near where Amy was attacked. From the magazine, they established that he had a blank firing prop gun with him, not an actual firearm. The gun was produced by the Italian manufacturer Brixia, and it would typically be used in theatrical and film productions. It closely mimics the appearance and sound of a real gun, but it's incapable of firing live ammunition. This was 1994. The offender was not popping online and ordering this prop gun. So the idea was that he got it from a local theater group or studio, or possibly even stole it from somewhere like that. The investigators worked with several local theaters, but they crossed each one off the list because they were not missing a prop gun. You wonder why the killer would choose to bring a prop gun instead of a real gun. Did he have a criminal background that made it impossible for him to legally obtain a firearm? Or was this just something he had on hand for some reason? And when he set out that night, he had no intention of using a firearm. So we don't know the reason behind his choice.
Yeah, and we also don't know for certain that he's a local resident. You mentioned that they checked local theaters for if they were missing prop guns, but it could have, you know, the radius of the search could have been larger.
Yeah, I think it would make sense to expand out. And I think that's kind of what they tried to do by making this information public, is hopefully if you make this information about this prop gun public and ask for any theaters to come forward to say that they're missing a prop gun, then you can reach a broader group of people by putting it out there in the media. But I'm not sure how far or how widespread this information was.
Yeah, or even if, you know, any distributors of this prop gun sold it to an individual person rather than a theater.
Yeah, and something we haven't talked about yet is that this occurred during spring break, which Cocoa Beach was a spot for spring breakers. I mean, definitely not the top spot in Florida, but it was a spring break destination for some people. So you have people from all over there during that week that you wouldn't normally have. So it does just create a bigger pool of people who could have been involved.
Yeah, although would be a little odd to carry your prop gun with you on spring break, unless your intention is, you know, when you make your trip to Cocoa Beach for spring break, you're intending on robbing someone.
Yeah. When you put it like that, it doesn't seem likely. But all I'm saying is that there were more people there than there would be on any other given week. There was little DNA evidence in this case, but the Brixia Guns magazine was one of, if not the only item they collected DNA from.
So they found DNA, but he was wearing gloves. So this could have been from someone else, right?
Exactly. That's the problem with this evidence. It could belong to someone else who handled the magazine before the intruder obtained it, or it could be DNA from the person he was allegedly waiting on while he held Bunny and Bob inside their home. Alternatively, the offender could have loaded the magazine before he put their gloves on and entered their home. So it's not a lost cause. It could still be valuable evidence if they could match it to someone. And speaking of the gloves, they stood out to Bunny and Bob. They were knit with leather on the palms and backs. He wore black pants, a black shirt, and white tennis shoes. I guess he couldn't keep the black outfit up by wearing black shoes, but the gloves coupled with the ski mask seemed like something he would own if he were from a cooler climate than Florida. It was reportedly difficult to find a ski mask and gloves in Cocoa Beach during spring break when the attacks took place. The mask was interesting too, because it makes you think he entered their home without the intention of killing anyone. You don't need to hide your face if you're going to kill them. During the 48 hours segment, the investigators questioned if the intruder knew the family, despite Bunny and Bob not recognizing his voice. Maybe he didn't know them directly, but possibly from the community, and feared that after the attacks, they could cross paths. But Bunny in particular picked up on a Maryland or Pennsylvania accent from him, so he could have recently moved to Cocoa Beach from that area. Additionally, according to 48 Hours coverage, the man's voice was slightly higher pitched than the average male voice. Regarding physical characteristics, they obviously couldn't see much, but they believed him to be white because of the contrast between the ski mask and the skin around his eyes. They estimated he was in his 20s, about 5'8", with an average or medium build. Other than the intruder's voice, the height feels like the most important factor here, because if a suspect came on their list who was 6'3", okay, they're probably not mixing up 6'3 and 5'8". I know this was obviously a traumatic event for Bunny and Bob, which can affect memory, but they concurred on the description of this man. It's not to say that the investigators could rule out a much taller suspect based on that alone. It's just something to consider. One final clue was the way the intruder forced Bunny and Bob to position themselves. Investigators noted that the way they were positioned, with Bob on his stomach and Bunny on her stomach across his back, is a known technique for restraining captives, suggesting the intruder may have had military training. During the 48 hours interview, the investigator shared that he could have attended a police academy or worked as a security guard, even. So this was certainly another consideration when they reviewed suspects. Before we get into those suspects, Amy's dad, Dan, who had law enforcement experience, was quite vocal early on about his dissatisfaction with the investigation. 7 months after the murder in October 1994, Dan wrote to the governor of Florida requesting that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or the FDLE, and the FBI assist in the investigation. Dan stated that little had been uncovered since Amy's murder and that the sheriff had not returned his calls or replied to his letters since July, several months before. The sheriff defended his lack of communication, claiming there were no new updates to share, but at least return the phone calls, right? The case was still so fresh at that point. Dan believed the case could benefit from outside expertise. At the same time, Dan announced a $5,000 reward for information leading to a conviction in Amy's murder. As reported by Florida Today, he also criticized the sheriff's office for allegedly failing to search the dumpster in the parking lot where Amy was found. The sheriff insisted that his department had already been working with the FDLE and felt he could not satisfy Dan. About a month later, Dan's efforts proved successful, and it was officially announced that the FDLE would take on a larger role in the investigation. The sheriff was right. They had already been involved, but this was a win from Dan's perspective because they would be more involved. So it brought additional resources and expertise to his daughter's murder. I'm going to tell you about the suspects in order from the people who are considered by the investigators the least likely to be involved to the most likely. Nearly a year after the murder, authorities revealed they had questioned then 24-year-old Jeffrey Anderson in connection with the stabbings. Jeffrey, a convicted burglar, had led police on an 8-minute car chase near Cocoa Beach the day after Amy's murder. According to Florida Today, the chase started when he fled a routine traffic stop in a stolen car, eventually ending on Merritt Island after he collided with four vehicles. Reportedly, Bunny's credit cards were found by the transient man, discarded near where the chase ended. Also, fiction books about homicide were found in the car, but there was no proof they were relevant to the case, as well as other stolen credit cards, but they did not belong to Bunny and Bob. Importantly, Bunny and Bob did not identify Jeffrey in a voice lineup, and police found no direct evidence linking him to the stolen credit cards or Amy's murder. At one point, Dan expressed that he felt the investigators were hyper-focused on Jeffrey, implying they may have had tunnel vision earlier in the investigation. And while the investigators couldn't completely rule him out, it seems now they find it unlikely he was responsible for Amy's murder.
Do we know how long they focused their efforts on this guy?
It sounded like quite a while based on what Amy's dad said. But I'm not clear when they were able to say, okay, it's most likely he wasn't involved. Around the same time that Jeffrey was looked into, in April 1995, 24-year-old Larry Jones Hand III was investigated in this case. He had recently been convicted of first-degree murder for stabbing a man named Alonzo to death on Merritt Island and was also charged with the attempted murder of another man named Stephen in a violent attack that same day. The attack occurred 8 months after Amy's in December 1994. That night, Alonzo was beaten and fatally stabbed by Larry in his own home. Later, Stephen was attacked, similarly, beaten and then slashed with a machete before his wife managed to fend off the assailant with mace. Before fleeing, the attacker rummaged through a purse inside their car, suggesting Larry was after their valuables. So I know I said the attacker, but it was later established that this was, in fact, Larry who carried out both of these crimes. Larry had a long history of substance abuse, particularly with crack cocaine, and had received counseling from both Alonzo and Stephen. He was regularly using drugs in the lead up to their attacks, and it was possible he had been using at the time of Amy's murder as well. Just weeks after her killing, in April 1994, he entered a treatment center he had been to before.
And just to clarify, this is in the Cocoa Beach area?
The attacks took place on Merritt Island, which, I mean, depending on where exactly they took place, it's approximately 10 miles away from Cocoa Beach. So pretty close by. And that's kind of what drew the attention of Stephen, the victim who survived. He was the one who seemed to piece together that his attack was similar to Amy, Bunny, and Bob's. So he reported his suspicions to the sheriff's office.
So we know Amy had a history of using drugs, not necessarily crack cocaine, like Larry, but do we know if they were associated in any way?
Not through a rehab or anything related to drugs, but Larry attended the same church at one point as Alonzo and Stephen, but then he started going to the church Amy, Bunny, and Bob attended. Now, we don't know if they knew each other. No one remembered them knowing each other. It didn't sound like Bunny and Bob remembered Larry, but the pastor said it was likely they crossed paths at some point.
Was it a fairly large church or was it kind of a smaller community church?
You know, I'm not exactly sure, but I guess we can deduce that it wasn't so small that they would have had to have known each other. So it's up in the air whether they crossed paths at some point. The other similarities were that all of the victims were stabbed, and in each instance, the attacker stole or attempted to steal cash and credit cards. However, Larry's attorney maintained that he had an alibi when Amy's murder took place, and because I found very little follow-up on this lead or any mention of a voice lineup, I believe the investigators dismissed him as a suspect. I still wanted to share this, especially because of the church link and with Bunny and Bob being psychologists and Alonzo and Stephen having provided counseling to Larry. I wondered if Bunny or Bob ever worked with him, but it doesn't appear that was the case. Then there was Hugh Popple, who had once been romantically involved with Amy. He wasn't considered a suspect until 2013, nearly 19 years after the murder, when an anonymous tip was submitted to Crimeline. This tip surfaced after Hugh was killed in a hit-and-run accident, with someone remarking that his death was karma for what he had done to Amy Gellert. A close friend of Amy's told 48 Hours that Hugh had a destructive streak. He struggled with substance abuse and was known to have a volatile temper. While no physical evidence links him to the crime, and the comment about Hugh could have just been a rumor, he remains on the list of potential suspects. And that brings us to the two top suspects. About a year after Amy's murder, Dominic Canuca, a 22-year-old short order cook from Pennsylvania, emerged as a suspect. At the time of Amy's murder, Dominic and his high school girlfriend, Julie, had recently moved to Cocoa Beach, at most a couple of months before Amy's murder. According to 48 Hours, investigators only learned about him when a coworker of Julie's came forward with a tip. The coworker reported overhearing Julie say that Dominic might have been involved in Amy's homicide. Julie denied saying this to anyone. Nevertheless, the detectives looked into Dominic and they discovered that he had stolen a car and abruptly left town the day after Amy's murder, eventually returning to Pennsylvania, where he was from. When investigators finally tracked him down, he told a bizarre and suspicious story. He admitted to being at the crime scene, claiming he had been driving home from work when he saw police lights outside of Amy's house. According to Dominic, he stopped out of curiosity. He claimed he was a concerned citizen and even helped an officer put up crime scene tape.
Yeah, that's really weird. Like, why would you just let a random stranger help you do that if you're the police? But my question is, was Amy's house even on the way home for him? Was it on the path that he would usually take to get home?
I wondered that too, and I haven't seen that acknowledged. I wouldn't think he would lie about that. Something that could be easily disproven, right? But I just haven't seen one way or the other. But that would make it all the more suspicious if it wasn't actually on the way home. But the investigators pointed out this whole him apparently helping to put up crime scene tape, while not impossible, it was highly unusual for a random bystander, especially someone like Dominic, who had a criminal past, to assist law enforcement at a homicide scene. Further, Dominic was AWOL from the Marine Corps at that time. So given that he was wanted by the military, it seemed unlikely he would willingly approach law enforcement. His military records described him as prone to explosive behavior, suffering from high anxiety, and potentially violent. As a former Marine, he would have been trained in knife combat, adding another layer of suspicion, and Dominic was allegedly known to have a particular interest in knives. The investigators had already suspected that, based on how the intruder forced Bunny and Bob to position themselves, he may have had a military background, and Dominic is the only suspect, as far as I'm aware, who had that background. And Dominic matched the height and build of the intruder.
So this has to be the top suspect, right?
He's not actually the top suspect. So we're getting to the number one suspect. But Dominic's story quickly fell apart when the detectives checked his time card at the restaurant where he claimed to have worked that night, only to find out he hadn't worked the night of Amy's murder at all. With Dominic being from Pennsylvania, he was the one suspect on the list who could have an accent that matched what Bunny and Bob picked up on. But for reasons unknown, a voice lineup was never done with Dominic. This makes no sense to me. He came up on their list fairly early on, within the first year. So it's not like he came up 20 years later and they thought it wouldn't make sense to do a voice lineup now because so much time has passed, which I would think it would still make sense. But this was within a year. So I don't understand why a voice lineup was not done when we have two people who we know spent 30 minutes with this man and heard his voice. Dominic having recently moved to Florida from Pennsylvania, where he would have experienced colder winters, could also mean he had items like gloves and masks. The investigators could never make a solid link between Dominic and Amy, but he was reinvestigated and questioned along with his former girlfriend in 2015, 21 years after Amy's murder. Dominic was serving time in a Pennsylvania prison for robbing a pharmacy. Dominic agreed to speak with the investigators and was strangely confident during much of their conversation. But when they asked him specific questions about the case, Dominic became defensive. He still admitted to stopping at the scene, but he maintained his innocence. Like most of the suspects in Amy's murder, he had a history of substance abuse. He said to investigators, his words, not mine, "I'm just an addict. How could I do that?" They basically learned nothing new from Dominic during the 2015 interview. At that time, like I said, they also spoke with Dominic's ex-girlfriend, Julie, the one whose alleged comments to a coworker prompted the sheriff's office to look into him. When asked years later if she commented to a coworker about Dominic possibly being involved in Amy's murder after having denied it, Julie said she may have said something like that in jest, which I don't understand. I can't imagine saying something like that in jest, but Julie was willing to talk about Dominic. She said he had a good side and a bad side, but she couldn't remember specifics from that time so many years later. Dominic claimed he drove Julie's vehicle the night of Amy's murder when he stopped at the crime scene, but she couldn't remember if he was driving her vehicle, and she also couldn't recall Dominic saying he stopped at the scene. There are a lot of little pieces of information that would have to be strange coincidences if Dominic is not involved. Dominic stopping at the crime scene and then leaving Florida the day after Amy's murder. That is strange, as well as his accent being from the same region as that of what Bunny detected from the intruder. And he lied about being at work that night. And he had the military background they suspected the intruder might have. I mean, one coincidence is one thing, but to have all of these at once, it's unusual if he's not involved. But as interesting as Dominic is in this case, there's no hard evidence against him. And just when you thought he might be the number one suspect, enter Scott Manley. Although we're talking about him last, he came on the investigators' radar right after the attacks. Scott could be charming, but many saw him as a con artist. He had a known issue with crack cocaine and first crossed paths with Amy in rehab. Though he was 2.5 years older and also from Cocoa Beach, their shared experience in the straight rehab program initially kept them connected in their efforts to stay clean. However, while Amy worked to stay on track, Scott struggled more significantly, leading to multiple stints in rehab across New Jersey and Pennsylvania. By the fall of 1993, Scott was back in Cocoa Beach and using drugs again. Scott re-entered Amy's life and they had been spending time together before her murder. His renewed presence in Amy's life deeply worried her brother, Ryan. Although Amy was trying to stay on the straight and narrow, like I said at the beginning, her friends reported that she had started smoking weed again before her murder. Just days before her death, Amy asked her brother Ryan to accompany her to the apartment complex where Scott Manley lived with his parents. She needed to retrieve something from him. But the request unsettled Ryan. He couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. Why was she still involved with Scott? Why did she need his help for this? Some of her friends claimed that Scott owed her money as they had pooled their cash to buy drugs. Even Scott himself later admitted to being in debt to Amy. Had his debt grown to an insurmountable amount in Scott's eyes? Something to consider. On the evening of Amy's murder, Scott went to Amy's house and saw her as she was leaving for church. Scott told the investigators that he had plans to meet up with Amy later that night after she returned from church. Instead, just 30 minutes after her murder, he left a message on her answering machine, casually saying it was 9:30, so it was too late to go out and that he'd call her later in the week. Investigators found the timing of the call suspicious. Why would he suddenly change plans right after she was killed? Initially, Scott claimed he had seen a friend that night, but the friend did not corroborate this. Scott later changed his story, saying he had gone out to buy drugs, looking for a dealer, specifically a white man with a northern accent named Nick. And Scott claimed he drove around using crack cocaine that night. Amy and Scott having plans didn't ring true to her friend Andrea because she told 48 Hours that she had plans with Amy that night to walk on the beach and didn't believe Amy would have made plans with both of them. And for some reason, I get the sense that 9:30 would not be too late for Scott to see someone.
Yeah, if he was involved, he probably thought the phone call at 9:30 was, in his perspective, some sort of alibi to suggest that he didn't have anything to do with it.
That's a good point. Even though it was 30 minutes or so after the attacks ended, he still could have thought that the timing was so close that they would think he couldn't have been involved. Because why else would he do that? If she truly had plans with her friend, Andrea, then I really don't think Amy would have been making plans with both of them. The morning after Amy was killed, Scott went to law enforcement to explain why he left that voicemail canceling his meetup with Amy. So he came right in and volunteered this information. They, at that point, weren't even thinking it was that suspicious. So he explained what I already shared about the alleged plans he had with Amy. But he also stated that he went to Amy's house that night before she headed to church, which we already talked about. But he said he was going there to pay $30 that he owed to her. His dad drove him there, but he actually pocketed the $30 and it was all a sham. Scott claimed he was home before 9 p.m. on the night of the murder and his parents confirmed this. If true, it would have been impossible for Scott to be responsible for the attacks. Scott went on to commit various crimes, including robbery, yet they found no solid evidence to connect Scott to Amy's murder and Bunny and Bob's stabbings. And I don't know if a voice lineup was done with Scott. I presume it would have been mentioned if Bunny and Bob picked him out of the voice lineup, but we also know he left a voicemail on their answer machine. So it seems like if they heard that, they would have said immediately, oh, that's the voice of the guy who did this. So I think that's pretty key here that they did not seem to connect Scott's voice to the intruder's voice.
Yeah, there is a little distortion talking in person versus on the phone, but you know, I agree with that, that it does play in his favor that they couldn't recognize the two, or they couldn't put the two together, rather.
Right. I do know Scott matched the height and build of the intruder, just as Dominic did, but that's about it as far as the description of the intruder. Once the investigators started looking into Dominic, they began to question if both Scott and Dominic could be involved because they looked into Dominic after Scott, but Dominic and Scott deny knowing each other, although the investigators found one potential link. According to Scott's dad, Scott once had a job interview at Gatsby's, the restaurant where Dominic worked as a cook, and it sounded like this was while Dominic worked there. Later, a waitress from Gatsby's picked Scott out of a lineup as someone she believed came into the restaurant looking for Dominic at some point during the fairly short period Dominic worked there. Also, Scott claimed he was looking to buy drugs from a white man with a northern accent named Nick the night of Amy's murder. Could Nick be short for Dominic? Well, no one could say Dominic ever went by Nick, only by Dom. But could they have met somehow, and Scott convinced Dominic to break into Amy and her parents' home while he acted as the getaway driver? The investigators looked into this, but have not been able to prove this theory. The DNA profile from the Prop Guns magazine has been compared to the suspects in this case, and there has not been a single match. So they either don't have the right person on their list, or the DNA belongs to someone other than the perpetrator who has not been identified yet. So we've discussed the suspects, yet the investigators don't have a clear motive in this case, but they have stated they think it was a targeted attack. Was Amy the target all along? The intruder didn't have to stab her or anyone, but he could have fled at the back door when Amy arrived home. It's not like she should have been a huge threat, but he went out of his way to stab her. I was thinking back to the intruder asking Bunny and Bob who else lived at the home, and they told him that the only other person was their daughter, and he referred to her as their daughter after that point. If he knew who Amy was, he didn't call her Amy. And if he knew who Amy was, he should have known that she lived there, especially if she was the target. Now, it could be that the getaway driver had the connection to Amy, Bunny, or Bob, and didn't give all the relevant information to the person who broke into the home. This can make sense in the theory that Scott was the getaway driver and Dominic was the intruder, because Scott was the one who had the connection to Amy and the family. And Dominic had no known connection to them. So he may not have known her name or who exactly lived at the house. But why would Scott or anyone want to kill Amy? Maybe that wasn't the plan. Maybe the plan was to steal from them and everything went awry. Then Bunny and Bob came home early and the getaway driver never showed up. But then why not accept the valuables that Bunny and Bob were offering up? That's what doesn't make sense. And you'd think a burglar would flee as soon as Bunny and Bob arrived home, even if their driver was not there.
Well, I could see him not wanting to take their car. They offered up the car. It'd be pretty easy to spot.
Yeah, but jewelry or other expensive items in their home?
Did they offer those? I thought you just mentioned that they offered.
No, Bunny had a lot of expensive jewelry and he didn't accept any of it. She did offer it to him.
The fact that this man got enraged almost instantaneously when Amy arrived is interesting. That definitely sounds like it fits Dominic's profile more easily than it does Scott's.
Mm-hmm. Because his girlfriend said he could switch between being a nice guy, not a nice guy, and then the military background of being explosive. Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of thinking maybe Bunny heard Amy pull up and she was blaring her music. I'm wondering if he got so angry because, you know, the music was so loud that it was drawing attention to the situation that was happening from surrounding neighbors, potentially, since the music was so loud.
Possibly. Or, you know, he could have realized in that moment that his getaway driver was not there and now he was having to deal with a third person. And that just really upset him. Because if Amy was the target, why is he getting enraged when she arrives home? You would think he would be thinking, now's my time to attack. Unless that's what he had to do to get himself in a mindset to start stabbing people. I don't know. That's possible. Or it could be like you said. He was fearful that now there was someone else there who was drawing attention to what was going on and he had no one there to pick him up. He was going to have to flee on foot. Of course, the investigators also looked into the theory that Bunny or Bob could have been the targets, not Amy, possibly a disgruntled former patient from their line of work as psychologists. But with the mask, it seemed as though he planned to keep Bunny and Bob alive. He did not want them to look at him, and they didn't recognize the man's voice. So it was likely not someone they knew directly, and they didn't attack until Amy arrived home. If his goal was to harm Bunny and Bob, why wait unless he was waiting for his driver to show up?
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. Like, why wait for so long to do this if they were the targets? And maybe that's why he got so mad, because I suppose there's the possibility that he didn't know what car would be showing up to be the getaway driver. And, you know, he thought his driver was just blaring music, which, you know, obviously is not going to be conducive to this situation that they're in.
Yeah, that's a possibility. And then when he got outside, he realized it wasn't someone who was there to pick him up and it was Amy. But then I still wonder, why not just run past her at that point? She would not have gotten a good look at him. He had a ski mask on. He was covered. I just don't really understand why you then stab her. And they weren't able to find people in Bunny and Bob's life to connect to them as being possible suspects like they could with Scott Manley. They just couldn't really find anyone. So the theory that Bunny and Bob were targeted and this had nothing to do with Amy is not the leading one. I mentioned 48 Hours multiple times because it was a great source of information for this case as they featured it in 2015. That coverage brought new, fresh leads. However, it's been 10 years since it was featured and Amy's murder is still unsolved. Bunny and Bob are forever changed by Amy's murder and their attack. They have said there is no day more difficult for them than March 20th. It's a dreadful day for them. They attribute their ability to carry on to their faith, but it would be helpful for them to know that the person who did this cannot do it to anyone else. If you have information related to the murder of Amy Gellert, please contact the Homicide Division of the Brevard County Sheriff's Office at 321-633-8413. Thank you all so much for listening to our coverage of this case. You can always share your thoughts with us through comments on Spotify or Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast or email at keytothecase@gmail.com. That is all for now, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.